it's strange, in my research on it, I've read Oliver Wendell Holmes' decision from 1922, and the strange thing about it is that he ruled that the fact that baseball teams cross state lines to play their games was only incidental, which in retrospect seems very odd. Baseball to him was the equivalent of the Chautauqua Society, which had business offices in one place and simply sent out
representatives
to other parts of the country.
I thought you looked familiar.
Interesting view.
Yeah. As if the spot.
How about that?
As if the games were just spontaneous exhibitions.
Mm-hmm. As if they would affect people's lives to a huge degree.
Linen, web,
That's, 70 years ago.
And the exemption still holds.
Sure.
On the books, even though it's sort of moot at this point. I'm going to turn this off for a minute. Scheduling was one of the big concerns for players in the 60s, too.
We used to go on a 2-week road trip. Right? Nowadays, I think it's only something like 18 consecutive days or something without an off day or something. It has to be. But sure, schedule is very, very much. I mean, the quality of the play and the possibility of injury because of fatigue and stress and long hours and travel days and all that sort of stuff definitely is something to be considered.
That's something the fans really have no sympathy for.
No.
Conception of, right?
But it's fine.
Was that my friend?
No, I'm fine. Thanks. No, they have no idea. You know, they work during the day and then they want to come out and be entertained by the professional athletes. They have no idea what the players go through as far as traveling, airports and buses and hotel rooms.
They think the whole thing's a joyride.
They just show up and they expect to see a good effort. And the players want to give them a good effort. But we're not machines. And it's a long season starting in mid-February and all the way to October. With the time zone, airports, and buses, like I said, and they put on little nagging injuries and all that sort of stuff. And the other pressures outside of baseball, your regular life, your family, and conditions that affect your family and you or away from the ballpark,
separation.
I mean, it's incredible. Yeah, it's more than meets the eye, that's for sure.
In the time you spent.
Going back, talking about schedule, one thing, to go back, I mean, the players have always advocated a shorter season, obviously. I mean, how many games are in terrible conditions in April in most of the northern tier states and Canada now? Players have always advocated a little shorter season and a little more off, a couple more off days and a little better, more travel, off days on travel days and stuff. And I think well-rested teams would be a better product. And certainly more and less injuries, I think. But the owners, don't want to do that, obviously, and they could have a couple more off days, I think, if they went back to some doubleheaders. They could play 5 or 6 doubleheaders during the year and have some more off days. The owners, of course, think of two gates instead of one gate. And, you know, right. They're business people. They understand that. But what in the end is going to be best for the players, best for the management, and best for the fans? You have to consider that.
You know, the Red Sox are the most extreme in that. When they have to make up a game, they have that day-night doubleheader.
Well, they also have the smallest ballpark in the majors, too. So they need... But, yeah, I mean, that's...
They don't want to give up any admissions anymore.
Pardon?
They don't want to give up any admission dates.
No, they don't. Not when they, you know, they... It's a very premium ticket in Boston, to say the least.
I went to 25 games at Fenway last year. It was joyous.
It was.
Love it.
A wonderful park.
Yep.
I'm glad I had an opportunity to play in Boston. Well, also, we'll be involved in one of those series there.
Yeah, I was going to get around to that series. Is that the peak year of your career, would you say? Plus playing in the series?
Well, for a couple of different reasons. First of all, I had come back from a very serious arm injury the year before. And my career was jeopardized. And I went through a lot of grief, a lot of rehab, a lot of hard work in the offseason to come back and lead that team. The 19 wins, a playoff win, and a World Series win in the sixth game of the 75 series. I'm going back to 74. I was traded to Reggie Smith and come over as a 16-game winner and the starting winning pitcher for an All-Star game the year before. And then Darryl Johnson, for what reason I'll never know, bypassed me a couple of times the first couple of weeks of the season. When it was my turn to pitch, bypassed me like it was September or something like that, and I wasn't pitching well. And I ended up pitching on a drizzly, miserable, cold day, rain and everything, 37-degree weather, and pitched my first complete American League win. But it was not without its cost, because I hurt my arm and torn my tricep muscle in the process. And basically, it was out. I pitched a couple more times, and then tendonitis, and all that sort of stuff. But it was for that reason I could come back and just enjoy pitching healthy again. And then to come back and lead the team to a pennant was very special. I mean, it was Fred Lynn and Jim Rice that year, and Denny Doyle, Rico Cappuccelli. I mean, it was a wonderful year all the way around. That was what was felt so special. It would have been a special year, obviously, but under those circumstances, and not knowing the previous year during the winter whether I'd be able to pitch, you're going to be able to come back. That's what made it special. I don't think a lot of people realize that. I won a lot of games after that, but that was a very trying time for me. I found it 74.
Could have happened over.
Could have been.
Was that your first arm problem?
Yes.
Very traumatic.
Very traumatic. It's a lot of things go through your mind there when you're not able to do the things you love the best. But, you know, it's such a limited career to begin with that you never know from year to year.
Do you think pitchers, in a way, run a race against time with their arms? Like a time bomb in most pitchers' arms waiting to blow up on them?
I think that's what doctors say, just a matter of time. I mean, before you camp. Because, after all, you figure that major league pitchers, if they're like me, and they started when they're 5 or 6 or 7 years old, in the Little League, in the Babe Ruth, American Legion, the high school, in the college, JC, or in the 4-year program, and then in the professional. I mean, the human arm was not made to throw a baseball over. That's why you see Eddie Finkel, the king of the sport, that's why he's still throwing a 66 or whatever, because that's the natural hang of the arm. To throw underhand. all the strain and trauma put on our arm is when you come over here. And then you add that, you know, with breaking pitches, with stress you put on sliders and curve balls, fork balls, all that sort of stuff. Time and time and time and time and time again. But funny, I think back in the 60s and 70s, I don't see half the problems I see nowadays. The pitcher's arms breaking down, and I don't know why. The guys were durable. I mean, they pitched every 4 or 5 days for 250, 300 innings, year after year after year.
There was no such thing. You
never heard anything. What was a rotator cuff? There was no such animal at that time. Why is it prevalent now? Good question.
And it baffles me. A guy like John Franco pitched 25 innings in half a season and went on the shelf with a bad arm.
It can happen any time. It really can. And it's a very, very thin line there between being healthy and being able to do your job and be on a DL and going through rehab and wondering how to pitch again, make a living as a professional baseball player.
A lot of great pitchers' careers ended abruptly. Drysdale. Stottlemyre. I guess he had a rotator cuff before they knew what it was.
Suter, John Tudor. Sure. I mean, lots of guys.
It's like they fall into a Bermuda Triangle for pitchers.
You never know. I mean, you can go anytime. You really can. It's not. I mean, there's football players have it now too. You know, quarterbacks and rotator cuff and all this sort of stuff. But the pitchers, you never know when the next pitch is your last pitch.
Does anybody ever had a better day than you did when you pitched the no-hitter and get the 2 home runs? Not that I know. Does that seem like a dream sometimes, that day?
That was a fabulous, fabulous day. And particularly coming against the team that I pitched against, that Cincinnati Reds lineup, all it has. They have at least 2 Hall of Famers here now. Maybe there's a couple more coming up out of that lineup. But on the road against them, I was coming off. I felt terrible. I mean, I was coming off the end of the bout with the flu, and I felt weak. Weak as can be warming up. It was extremely humid. It was 95. The humidity about the same. And in all honesty, I thought, man, it's going to be a tough night if I can't keep the ball down and spot the ball. Because I was throwing the ball. I was trying to throw as hard as I could, and the ball wasn't going or warming up. But perhaps the humidity and the heat, I don't know, maybe I sweated some of the stuff out, but I got out there and got through 3 innings, and I thought myself was getting stronger. And my concentration became... I mean, and then I hit the first home run. Roger Fried had driven a run, and I drove Roger Fried in the first home run, and I felt my strength, my spirits were high, and my strength started coming back, and but I really had to bear down because I realized the potential of this lineup that I was facing. They could explode at any time. But it just kept rolling along. It was amazing, that's for sure.
It's a magical night. Did anybody come close to a hit that
one? Larry Boa made a nice play. I think it was the first. Lukovich made a nice play, but routine for him. It was a nice play, but nothing special. I made a play on a chopper over my head behind the mound. It wasn't close. I think Boa made the closest play. I think only 3 balls were out of the out to the outfield. I threw 94 pitches. Walked Concepcion in the 6th, which robbed me of a perfect game, but I'm not complaining. And then the 2 home runs is the second and last home run was against Clay Carroll. It was a very, very good reliever. He had fallen behind me 2-0. I looked down at third base, and the third base coach was there looking at me. He said, "You're hitting." so he didn't get what any pitch he would do. Threw a fastball down the middle. But I hit it out.
But I remember Mike Ryan was my roommate a couple of times. And he was who I hung out with a lot. I always showed.
He kept saying that night as we left the station. He kept saying, do you know, do you realize what you did? Do you know what you did? Jeez. Do you realize what you did? Do you know what you just got through doing? I said, we just kept laughing and walking up towards the center of town. And, you know, obviously, we're cloud nine, but it was, you can't describe things like that. It's once in a lifetime.
It sounds like something you do in Little League.
Yeah, that's true.
No hitter hit two home runs. Not against the Cincinnati Reds.
That's true. Not in Riverfront Stadium, but against Bench and Morgan and Foster and Lee May and Tommy Hills and the rest of the guys. It was, I wish more people would have been there. I think it was only like 13,000 or 14,000. Something like that. But the next day I had literally 50 or 60 telegram cards and messages underneath my door. I didn't get a book for 3 hours in the morning, obviously. But it was a great experience. One home run and no-hitter has happened 3 times in history, but that was the only one, and probably will be for a long time since I was relatively.
Yeah.
No, those pitches are not hitting at all, and now,
I want to see if you agree with this. One of my objections to the DH. It's not so much on the major league level. All the games I went to in Boston, I didn't miss watching hitters pitch. But I watch Little League,
well, of course,
youth leagues using a DH, and it encourages or discourages people from being complete players. You were a complete player. And a lot of kids now, it's, we got a guy, Kevin Moss, comes up to the majors as a DH because he has no.
Well, and obviously it will limit trades between the two leagues because when the DH is in the National League, if they flip-flop during a game in the National League, you're expected to go out there and be able to catch the ball, throw the ball, cut off people, know the game situation. Whereas a DH, obviously, most of the time is a liability in the field and doesn't play accordingly, and is a one-dimensional player. Whereas National League players have to go run bases, like I said, cut off people, throw people out, throw the bases, and play defense, which wins games as much as a bat does. In fact, I mean, it's just as important, if not more important, to be able to win a game of defense as it is to. But of course, the DH was instituted because of the difference in the league, because of the attendance at the time, because the American League needed to hype their attendance because they were woefully behind the National League in attendance, and they had to do something to get people to the turnstiles. So, I mean, it was strictly a business thing.
And it was first conceived as a reaction to the pitcher's dominance in the late 60s.
Sure.
They start experimenting with it in the 60s.
Happen. right thing.